Okay. Thank you very much. Can you hear me at the back? Good. Just over a year ago, the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta asked me to think about some of the issues in measuring and managing risk of new forms of financial innovations. One of the first things you have to do before you can actually measure risk is to identify the risk. The outline presentation is going to be, first, I'm going to talk about pricing, then I'm going to talk about design characteristics of an innovation, then I'm going to talk about liquidity, then I'm going to talk about counterparty risk, and then risk management, and the last topic I'm going to talk about arose from a decision to be concrete. Given that the recent crisis has centered around credit, I decided to really concentrate the focus on credit to make it concrete. So the last part is going to deal with credit ratings. I should add that there's a certain degree of obtuseness in putting these topics in this order. So you may think, hey, certain topics should be discussed here. Hopefully, it'll get discussed soon before we end. If not, please ask a question. But I do ask for your patience. Okay. To be concrete, I want to consider some form of collateralized debt obligation. This could be any type of structure. Precise details are not really important. There really are two approaches to take. One is modeling from a bottom-up approach, looking at the individual assets in the collateral pool, and basically modeling how these assets behave, and then you get a bottom-up approach. Alternative approach is top-down. That is, you just start from top-down. You don't really consider the individual assets. Then we're going to talk about the implications of these two approaches for new forms of financial products. Well, at the individual asset level, and an asset may be a mortgage, maybe an asset-backed security, we need to model both the probability of a default and the loss given default over the horizon of the structure. Well, to model the cash flows generated by the assets in the collateral pool, it's necessary to consider how default affects the remaining assets. Default, in fact, by a particular asset may be beneficial for the remaining assets, less competition. Or it may, in fact, signal that a particular sector or the whole economy is in trouble, so it could, in fact, be bad news. The challenge, of course, is how do we actually model default dependence? But one approach is to assume the probability of default for a particular asset depends upon a set of obligor-specific and macro factors. Well, this immediately raises the questions, what factors do you want? And secondly, how on earth do you estimate the functional dependence? An alternative approach is to assume that we know the marginal distributions of default for individual assets and then link them together. Now, this would be appropriate for some form of synthetic type of CDO. The link function is called a copula function. David Lee introduced that into at least this arena, popular in credit metrics. And of course, since then, almost every month, Risk Magazine publishes yet another type of copula function. So that raises the questions, which function do we pick, and how on earth do we estimate the parameters of the copula function? Finally, we also want to deal with what happens when default occurs. How much do you actually get back? Of course, as the credit crisis has taught us, recovery rates can, in fact, be extremely low. An alternative approach is saying, hey, instead of dealing with individual assets, why don't we just basically model the cash flows that are generated so we don't really burrow down to the individual asset level? This avoids having to explicitly model default dependence and the loss given default for the individual assets. The advantage of this approach is the number of parameters that must be estimated and calibrated is relatively small. Well, what are the implications for a new product? With your product, there's a real trade-off between model complexity and data availability. For either the bottom-up or top-down approaches, the issue is to estimate or to calibrate the parameters. The usual procedure is to calibrate a subset of extant prices, if available. Well, the limited liquidity of prices and the deficiencies of the model are impounded into the model parameters. This increases the parameter uncertainty or instability. Also implies that some certainty with respect to the accuracy of posted prices, especially for highly illiquid assets. For a new product, there is little, if any, empirical evidence about the accuracy of the model or its hedging ability, especially in different market conditions. But the design of an instrument affects its appeal to different clientele's potential users and defines its risk-sharing characteristics. On the demand side, the instrument should help to reduce the cost of achieving some service, and on the supply side, enhance the ability to use other instruments to hedge the different dimensions of risk. Well, given the design features of any new instrument, there's a need to identify the risk characteristics of the instrument. Well, the factors that drive the risk of innovation dictate the instruments that will be used for hedging. The ease of hedging, of course, will depend upon the features of the how the features of the innovation mesh with features of extant instruments that can be used for hedging. For example, rollover dates on default swaps matching the international money market dates. Well, the design affects the risk characteristics. The challenge, of course, is to identify these risk characteristics. Perhaps one of the biggest failings in the credit crisis was the failure to identify the binary or 0-1 nature of subprime asset-backed CDOs. This failure occurred not only on the part of regulators, banks, so-called sophisticated investors. Why did this occur? Well, basically, you had initially low levels of subordination, narrow trench widths, inability to roll over mortgages due to falling house prices, and state-dependent default dependence of mortgage defaults across different states, for example, California versus Florida. Initially very low, but all of a sudden, they in fact became very high. And consequently, what happened? Well, if one bond defaulted, it's almost certain that other bonds have defaulted, and you ended up with a so-called domino effect. If you want a more detailed discussion, see the paper of Michel Cruy, Robert Jarrow, and myself. Design features of an innovation may make it sensitive to market disruptions. For example, special investment vehicles. They invested in long-term assets. How did they finance the investments? Basically, they issued short-term commercial paper. Well, the fall in house prices and increased uncertainty about the value of the underlying collateral, vehicles had to reduce the amount of commercial paper they issued, forcing them to sell assets to meet claims. Well, this put more pressure on asset values, producing so-called wrong way and feedback. Well, due to the uncertainty about the valuation of collateral, eventually investors refused to purchase asset-backed commercial paper. Notice, in these instruments, they did not have an option to extend the maturity of the innovation, the option, of course, being with the vehicle. In this part of the world, i.e. Canada, some people did. However, they had lousy lawyers, for the most part, because the bottom line here is they could have the ability to extend in the case of a market disruption. How do you define a market disruption? And that basically was the Achilles heel in this part of the world. But liquidity depends upon many different factors. The ability to grow both supply and demand, educating end users about the innovation, its risk-return characteristics, and identifying accounting and regulatory issues. The ease of pricing and innovation, and the transparency of pricing and innovation, the transparency of pricing, all affect liquidity. Existing set of hedging tools affect liquidity. Well, the ease of pricing depends upon the complexity of an innovation. If the innovation is relatively easy to price, this aids investors' understanding of the different role factors have upon price. Understanding the risk drivers goes a long way in increasing investors' confidence in posted prices and hence liquidity. A credit default swap is a relatively simple instrument. The structure of a collateralized debt obligation is complex, and the data requirements are formidable. This greatly increases both the data and analytical skills needed for pricing. The greater the complexity of the pricing process, the more uncertainty is about model prices adversely affecting liquidity. Well, the existence of a secondary market provides the investor with the ability to exit a position. For a new product, of course, there is limited liability. This increases the risk of entering the position and the cost of exiting. Institutions know this, and so often they agree to make a market. However, bid-ask spreads can be large, and they may be very state-dependent, i.e., when you need them, they may be extremely large. The ability to hedge provides a mechanism to alter the risk profile. It also increases the attractiveness of investing in innovation. For new innovations, we need to find the appropriate hedging instruments. The costs of hedging will be reduced if the design characteristics of an innovation mesh with existing types of instruments that could be used. Transparency. Well, the ability for investors to actually see posted bid-ask quotes on a regular basis helps to improve the transparency of the pricing process. The investment banks know this. In the fall of 2002, they introduced an index on a portfolio of 125 credit default swaps and agreed to post bid-ask quotes on a regular basis. The index was in fact successful. Why? Because of the relative simplicity of the design. In this case, simply credit default swaps and individual obligors. This helped to increase the liquidity of that market. It also helped to increase the liquidity of the credit default swap market. It also helped investors to calibrate their models. Counterparty risk. Well, counterparty risk is the risk that a party to a contract might fail to perform when called upon to honor its contractual commitments. It exposes the other party to a mark-to-market risk. For an innovation, how can we reduce counterparty risk? If collateral is posted, is the wrong way dependence? Well, how do we reduce counterparty risk for an innovation? Well, first, back office facilities. We need to develop back office facilities on a very timely basis. And as is well known in the credit default swap market, that has been a major issue. A master agreement helps to reduce counterparty risk as it allows netting. So for a new product, it provides incentive to standardize the contract terms. However, the more complex a product and innovation is, the more difficult it is to develop a master agreement. Clearinghouse. Of course, clearinghouses seem to be in vogue in Washington. Why? It concentrates counterparty risk, and then the only thing you have to do is to worry about the clearinghouse. which would be a good topic for PhD students to think about. Well, some contracts require the counterparty to make collateral payments on being downgraded. Well, there are a number of issues here. One, does the value of collateral decrease as the value of the underlying assets decreases? So-called wrong way dependence. The other issue are the implicit assumptions. One, that the counterparty only has a small number of contracts outstanding and the credit ratings are up to date. Well, the counterparty, in fact, may, in fact, have lots of different contracts with other investors. And hence, if it's downgraded, they will have to post a lot of collateral. The posting of collateral might, in fact, jeopardize its own solvency ability to keep on functioning. One thinks immediately of AIG. So, the other issue. Is the counterparty a major player in the innovation? And so, as pointed out yesterday, in terms of your filtration, which filtration set do you actually want, as Monique pointed out? Let's go on to talk about risk management. Well, risk management really entails the ability to identify, measure, and manage risk of a specified horizons. At specified horizon, we need to calculate the value of the portfolio of assets in each state and generate required risk measures. Well, to manage the risk profile means the ability to hedge. That means we have to calculate hedge ratios. If the pricing models are misspecified, that also implies hedge ratios are misspecified. Risk managers also have to attempt to identify dimensions of risk that are difficult to quantify, so-called dark risk. Data availability. Well, in innovation, what do we know? There's extremely limited data available. This affects the choice of pricing models. It's very difficult to be sophisticated if you have very little in terms of your model choice, if you in fact have very little data. Data availability also affects the ability to undertake the time series analysis of the properties of the price dynamics, also raises the question about whether it's possible to test a model. Well, models are often calibrated to a set of extant prices. In fact, most of yesterday was spent dealing with that issue. Our near innovation markets are illiquid. What does that mean? It means the effects of liquidity are compounded into the estimated parameter values. This increases the variability of parameters. How good is a model for hedging? Just because you've calibrated to extant prices today doesn't mean the model is very good for hedging. The risk manager can in fact stress test the model to determine the sensitivity of price, hedge ratios, etc. Well, if the model is deficient, the risk manager can end up with a very false sense of security. Well, dark risk. There are many different dimensions to dark risk. One, parameter instability, limited data, the effects of complexity of an instrument, and parameter uncertainty on pricing and hedging. Legal, settlement risk, accounting risk, political risk, has been demonstrated in the last few weeks in Europe, not to mention Washington, and of course, regulatory risk. Limited knowledge on the part of senior management. All of these are some other dimensions of dark risk. Let's talk about parameter instability. Well, risk managers can undertake so-called scenario analysis. This requires the risk manager to think outside the confines of the modeling framework. Often that's very difficult to do because of simply internal pressures. You know, what happens if model prices fall across the nation? How will this affect mortgage-backed BBB bonds, which was the average rating for bonds put into a lot of your structures? How will it affect the different tranches? What happens if default dependence increases? If you use historic data, historically, what did we know? Very low correlations. Historically, fine. But what happens if the whole economy goes down the drain? All of a sudden, those low correlations become very close to one. What are the consequences? You don't need fancy models to do this. You need a risk manager to stand back and to basically start making some professional judgments. Incentives. Risk managers need to reflect on how the success of an innovation affects the incentives of different players and the consequences. Let's consider subprime mortgage-backed CDOs. They were very profitable for investment banks. So, to ensure adequate supply, at least regarding mortgages, originators kept on lowering their underwriting standards. They, for the most part, were rewarded on the basis of quantity, not quality. Yes, some investment banks were wise enough to have put options, so they could basically force the originators to buy them back, but what happened? Well, the originators went bankrupt when those options were, in fact, exercised. This lowering of standards increased the probability of default. It lowered recovery rates, of course. Given the use of historic data, these changes were not reflected in actual pricing models used. What were the rating agencies doing? Did anyone ask? Well, the rating agencies have a very stated policy. They testified both in the Senate, both Moody's, Standard & Poor's, that A, they used historic data, and they did not check the validity of the data. Risk concentration. If you're a risk manager, what do you need to do? You need to recognize that holding different examples of an innovation may result in the concentration of risk. For example, holding different tranches, CDOs. Well, the same asset may in fact appear in many of these different tranches. Standard & Poor's reported that just 35 different borrowers appeared in over half of the 184 classified loan obligations that it in fact rates. Well, this raises the immediate question. Does the risk manager actually have the data to identify concentrations? Credit crisis indicated no. Does the risk manager, if they had the data, actually have the IT to find the concentrations? Accounting incentives. We introduce a new innovation. What do? We basically use an existing accounting system to accommodate the innovation. What do we know? Well, the traders know the accounting system backwards. They know its pluses and its minuses. Well, traders' incentives or bonuses are primarily determined by probability of their trading desk. And hence, they may undertake trades that are beneficial to them but are not beneficial to the firm. The challenge for risk managers is to understand the incentives and to analyze the types of trades undertaken. Limited knowledge on the part of senior management. Well, for innovation, when innovation is introduced, senior management may often not understand the innovation and its risk characteristics. They often refuse to acknowledge this ignorance, and they rely upon their traders and their quants to characterize the profitability and the risk. Traders' incentives are not aligned to those of senior management. You know, traders, if things blow up, they will just move, and the firm they move to will basically just give them the equivalent amount of the vested shares. Diligent managers need to, diligent risk manager may object to a certain trade and say, hey, this trade is really designed to profit the trader, not the firm. Are they going to receive support from senior management? Maybe not, because senior management is relying upon the traders and the quants to provide advice, the wolf guarding the sheep. Mark to model. Well, with an innovation, new innovation, there are greater operational risks. For example, identify accounting incentives, model risk, complexity risk, settlement risk, legal risk, regulatory risk. Do regulators actually understand the innovation? Should also add political risk. All these are additional costs. Are they reflected in a mark-to-model framework? No. rating agencies of certain types of instruments, a credit rating is often a prerequisite in order to increase its marketability. We can't invest in anything unless it's AAA. A rating, of course, provides a degree of blessing from the Pope. So, determining a rating for innovation is usually an interactive process between the issuer and the rating agency. It may involve both quantitative and qualitative assessments. Risk managers and investors not involved in these type of close discussions, the methodology is not transparent. What are the implications? Well, how does the methodology consider all the relevant risk factors? You're a risk manager. You actually look at all the relevant factors you've identified. Can you actually look at the factors the rating agencies have considered? But the methodology is not transparent. The answer is no. What does a rating actually measure? Can you actually get the rating agency to say, hey, it's a probability of default over the first year, or it's a probability of no default over the whole life, or it's a type of annual probability of default but averaged over the credit cycle? What data does a credit rating agency actually use? Well, it may use historic data that may be independent of current market conditions, which is maybe advantageous for the investment banks if previous conditions have been very benign. What are the appropriate distributional assumptions? Well, what do we know? We knew way back in 2005 that there was a lot of dubious actions going on by originators. You just have to look at the number of FBI prosecutions increasing starting in that time period. What use is a rating for an innovation? The meaning of a rating is unclear. The methodology is untested. Risk managers and investors, so-called sophisticated investors, need to remember the tentative nature of an innovation, of a risk rating methodology. Regulators. Well, regulators have even less incentives than senior management of an institution to understand the complexities and subtleties of an innovation. They have placed great faith, and sadly they continue to place great faith, on ratings. Well, for innovations, there is very little evidence to justify this reliance upon ratings. Well, what do we do? Well, the challenge is to identify all the different dimensions of risk. Stress testing may give a false sense of security. Scenario analysis requires risk managers to think outside the confines of the pricing models. Often, the environment inside firms doesn't allow that. You need the ability to hedge under different types of market conditions. All parties within a company, senior management, traders, and risk managers have important roles to play in identifying, assessing, measuring, and managing the different factors that contribute to the risk of a new product. Bearing in mind, all three of those players have very different incentive structures. The company directors, which you've heard presses learn about in the credit crisis, also have a responsibility to see that these duties are in fact fulfilled. Well, regulators, they face both micro and macro and systemic issues following the introduction of an innovation. Innovations, ratings are unreliable, hence it's inappropriate to, in fact, use ratings for capital determination, but that's what we do. The data about innovation should be available on a timely basis, when in fact it often isn't. Often isn't available on a timely basis, and often isn't available, period. For systemic risk, what do we hope for? Well, we'd hope that regulators have the ability to measure the holdings of an innovation by different institutions. That's what we'd hope for. However, if you're a US regulator, how do you know there's a whole bunch of German banks holding these instruments. You have no idea. So how on earth are you going to measure systemic risk? We also need the ability to monitor the buildup of concentration of holdings. And if you don't have the data, it's extremely difficult to do that if you do not have the data. Well, likely in Houston, but without the aid of an alarm clock, I've actually managed to finish on time, so I thank you very much.